Well, the United Nations Climate Change Conference is currently underway in Poznan in Poland in the lead-up to next year's climate talks in Copenhagen. And that Copenhagen Climate Change Conference is seen as a critical meeting because it'll outline the successor to the Kyoto Protocol. And much of the groundwork for this is being done in Poznan this week and next. My next guest is attending this conference. He's trying to get key parties there to agree to some basic rules on preventing the release of carbon that's still buried in the ground. Ralph Ashton is talking about the carbon held in the forests and soils of developing countries and where individual landholders and governments might be paid to keep the land as is and to keep the carbon buried. Ralph Ashton's a fellow in the Climate and Energy Program at the ANU, and he's the chair of the Terrestrial Carbon Group, which has just been formed. Before he headed off to Poland, I welcomed him to Saturday Extra.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
First of all, what do you mean when you refer to terrestrial carbon? Where is this carbon source actually found?
Terrestrial carbon really is carbon in the landscapes. So the main place for that will be in the soil, but also in forests and then in other living matter, both above the soil and in the soil.
So have you got a figure that you toss around as to how much it could provide of, say, 50% reductions by 2050 or 2060 or whatever it is that we aim for these days? How much do you realistically think the carbon in the ground could contribute to that figure?
We say, and this is based on analysis by McKinsey and Company, which has a very famous cost curve that gets spoken about. So looking at what is economically achievable by 2030, and that's avoiding dangerous climate change using a 450 parts per million target, that terrestrial carbon can contribute 25% of the overall climate change solution. So that's a very important number because it means it really says that you can't avoid dangerous climate change unless you do something with terrestrial carbon and really unlock that 25% of the solution. But you also can't just rely on terrestrial carbon and forests to solve climate change.
But if I get it correctly, you're saying, in effect, that has to be kept in the ground. So it's not unlocking it for use, it's keeping it locked away, isn't it?
Yeah, it's doing two things. It's stopping the ongoing emissions of carbon from the landscapes caused by deforestation and other land uses and burning forests, but it's also about growing new carbon, which is basically sucking carbon dioxide, greenhouse gases, out of the atmosphere back into the landscape. Because as a tree or other vegetation grows, it's basically taking carbon dioxide and making it into carbon, which is contributing to the climate change solution.
So the group that has been formed, this terrestrial carbon group, has a very impressive list of participants from around the world, including Warwick McKibben, who sits on the Reserve Bank Board and whom we've had on the program several times, and Joseph Stiglitz, the former Nobel laureate. Why is terrestrial carbon attracting such high-profile attention at this time?
I think there's been a building attention on terrestrial carbon and forests, and as the attention has built, there's been what I call a lot of shoulds. So people have been saying, you know, we should do this, but not a lot of how are we going to do it. So this group came together because they knew we should and they thought they could figure out a way of how can we do it. And then have a list of principles, how do we use terrestrial carbon to help avoid dangerous climate change, but go one step further and say, if you were the UN draftsperson having to come up with the treaty, or if you were enacting legislation, here's actually the detailed system of how you do it, which answers all the shoulds.
And what exactly are you proposing?
We're proposing, in very simple terms, to offer developing countries and people who have land and forests in developing countries a new commodity. So currently they can choose on a year-on-year basis to grow soy or beef cattle or dairy, whatever crop they want to grow on their land, or they can use it for infrastructure. So they have this economic choice that they're faced with depending on where the markets are. We're essentially saying create a new commodity which gives them one more economic development option. And that new commodity is selling the service of carbon storage. So saying you either keep the carbon you have there that you were going to chop down and emit into the atmosphere, keep it where it is, store it, or grow some new carbon and store it, and we'll pay you for that service. So
and pay you for both services. So we'll either pay you to grow or we'll pay you...
To keep.
What
you were going to emit. We're not telling you what to do. We're saying here's a part of the climate change solution that is massive, 25%, and we're giving you one new economic option. You choose, but we have to make that economic option more attractive to you than growing soy or chopping down your forest for cattle ranching.
Very clever, in theory. How would it operate in practice? I mean, how would a country deciding whether to sign up to this scheme, imagine a cabinet discussing this in Botswana, for the sake of argument,
yep.
Probably the wrong one, but how would it go about weighing up the relative merits of either?
Countries are already doing this process of sort of working out what their low carbon prosperity is. And so Guyana is a good example where they've had McKinsey and Company and others in working with them and with their own government staff to work out what is our future. So I think the key elements are to know how much carbon is in the landscape, how much would have been emitted under sort of a business as usual scenario were there no other incentive to keep it, and then work out, well, what economic income would I have got from that land if I had converted it into soy or beef or other productive uses?
Mm.
And what income will I get if I keep it in this carbon storage service?
And who's going to give them the money? Who? Where's the money coming from, the transfer? From whom? UN or what?
One place it could come from is an international fund. And so Norway has already contributed to such a fund and has an agreement with Brazil where they put money into a fund. If Brazil reduces its emissions from deforestation, it gets paid from this fund. Another way is to link it to carbon markets where you have, let's say in Australia, and we have an emissions trading scheme, or in Europe, and you're a power station and you're emitting greenhouse gases and you're emitting more than you're allowed to under your cap, then in a cap and trade system, you can trade. You can go and buy an emission reduction from somewhere else. So one way is then to allow that capped industry or
The coal industry in Australia, for the sake of argument.
The coal industry in Australia, transport, whatever it happens to be, to buy a credit from the person who's reduced their emissions from deforestation, for instance. So one way is to link it to a carbon market. One way is to link it to a fund. Another way, and I think you're seeing a lot of discussion about this, this is a global problem that needs global action. And so some countries, developing, fast emerging countries, will probably take on reduction targets themselves. So that would be another way.
Two questions, practical questions. How would the price be set for this? And which countries are most critical to the scheme's success then, would you say?
The price would be set, if it's a market-based mechanism, the price will be set by the market.
Right.
And the way really that price is set is by the supply and demand. So how stringent is your cap if you're using a cap and trade system, and how much supply of these credits are there? So it's, again, like any other traded commodity. Mm. If it's an international fund, that could be a negotiated price between countries. It could shadow or follow another market like the
European ETS.
It becomes
another form of aid to that extent, doesn't it? You may not like that term, but that's how it sounds.
It's definitely a transfer of money from one economy to another economy. Whether it's aid or trade depends on how the system is set up.
Which is what, I mean, for the first time, I suppose, it gives me something to think about in terms of rewarding developing countries for staying put. I mean, because they would say, well, if we're going to catch up to you, we have to follow much the same development lines. Now, this is a means of saying to them, well, no, there are other ways of doing this, I take it, so that if they were paid to keep the carbon in the ground, they could then use that money to build a brand new hospital for the sake. But that's what you're on about, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's also, it's really saying to them, you do have that right to do what other people in the world did, which was clear landscapes and develop. We're saying to you, we as the West or we as the rest of the world
aren't lecturing you.
We're not telling you can't do that. We're saying here's another development pathway.
Mm. So what countries are most critical?
Probably the countries with currently high rates of deforestation, so Indonesia and Brazil, are very important, but also countries with lots of carbon locked up in their landscapes that haven't necessarily seen the pressure on their forests yet, but that pressure will come in the next 50 years because of population going from 7 to 9 billion people, increased living standards.
Say China, is it?
Well, China's important from a consumption point of view, but from a deforestation point of view, in China, not so much. They've already enacted laws to stop deforestation. In fact, they're reforesting in China. But the demand they have for soy products and for timber products and for biofuels is so massive that their footprint around the world is massive and it's growing.
And what would the country say that before I diverted you on China, that you're saying haven't yet actually come to look at the carbon contained in their soils?
Yeah, so countries in the Congo Basin, for instance, a number of countries perhaps have been in conflict situations, and so the extraction of resources from forests has been very difficult. They're coming out of conflict. We've seen, say, Chinese investment that was blocked in Indonesia move immediately to Africa for biofuels production. This is a big problem. It's 50 years or 100 years to get the solution to climate change. We need to have a mechanism that deals with terrestrial carbon that will last that period and unlock it.
Very innovative, Ralph. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Ralph Ashton is the chair of the newly formed Terrestrial Carbon Group, talking about really a very new form of carbon credit, terrestrial carbon credits. And it'll be interesting to follow the development of this scheme to see whether anything comes out of Poznan. Now, in a related issue on ByDesign today, they're looking at the fleet of energy-efficient, lightweight electric cars that could be devised to take on the traditional automobile industry, given that it's in such dire straits, that this fleet of cars would be stacked like supermarket trolleys and could solve urban transport problems in one stroke. So that's ByDesign with an innovative Alan Saunders here on ABC Radio National after the 9 o'clock news. And it's now 21 to 9.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.